To many Jewish people, events in Israel on October the 7th were a big trauma. And to a few of us, just as big trauma was the reporting of it in some of the British media outlets. I was particularly disappointed with BBC and them not calling Hamas a terrorist organization. Actually, since then, I stopped watching them and I stopped listening to BBC News as well. And it's quite sad because they used to play a big role in my life as a news outlet. However, I've recently had a great conversation with the chair of Liberal Judaism, Karen Newman, who said or quoted chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Court, who said, "Complexity is not chaos." So something which we're going to address today is the complexities of the British media presentation of Israel and to discuss to what extent it actually affected other people's, non-Jewish people, perception of the Jewish people and Israel as well. And I'm delighted to introduce to you two very special guests who are on our podcast today. Joni Gould is a television and radio presenter at Talk TV and producer and presenter of Joni Gould's Jewish State podcast. Joni added podcasting to his 30-year career in broadcast journalism, emerging as Anglo-Jewry go-to interviewer. His outspoken commitment to these issues, to the issues and global Jewish and Israeli, Israel issues, led him to present on stage at Hillel's newer Geneva Summit for Human Rights and Democracy, where he interviewed Yazidis ISIS survivor Farida Abbas Khalif. As a board member of the Israel Diaspora Trust, Joni is also regularly briefed off the record by influencers and decision makers across the US, Israel and the UK. And I'm equally delighted to welcome Jonathan Sacerdoti, a British podcaster, journalist and TV producer. He covers stories related to the UK and Europe, as well as terrorism and extremism stories, race relations, Middle East analysis. He's also a campaigner against anti-Semitism. And Jonathan has joined us today all the way from Israel. Thank you so much to you both for being with us today.
Now, the idea, as Rabbi Tanya said, behind this particular episode of The Pondering Jew is to try and understand why it is that the state of British media, well, frankly, appears, at surface value, to be so anti-Israel. But of course, I dare say there'll be many people who work in the media who would say otherwise. And certainly my own experience of working in the media, and I know that as I work with Joni Gould and also Jonathan Sacerdoti from time to time, the fact that sort of I know that there are at least some of us who work within media who are not anti-Israel at the least. So hopefully trying to counter some of that. But of course, Joni, let's start off with you, because I happen to know from working with you probably slightly more, based on the fact that you and I both work at the same station, that you, as you interact, shall we say, with the great British public, considerably more than I do, it would appear as though that there is this perception out there that's come from somewhere for people who you'd be forgiven for thinking that they're not Middle Eastern scholars. So how the hell do they know what they know? It is so anti-Israel.
Yes. Well, let's start with where we work, Phil. And I am from Middle England. I am literally geographically from the centre of the country. And I remember a consensus of, if you like, traditional British values, be they working class labour or centre-right conservative middle class, or indeed working class conservatives, that gives me a faith and trust in the British public. And I have landed at this time in my career in a station where that Middle England tolerance still exists. And you only have to look at the Instagram feed of Talk TV tonight to see a very heroic soliloquy piece to camera from Mike Graham, our colleague, which is unapologetically pro-Israel, anti-Hamas, and pro-Western in its values, in the typical traditions, I think, of a Murdoch-owned media business. And perhaps the tragedy of this conflict amongst all is that I was 8 or 9 years at Sky News, where I reviewed the papers on sunrise. And I used that virtual decade of equity to appear one more time on the newspaper review. And I was trolled to high heaven for being basically pro-Israel. And the sadness is that we have degenerated into a series of echo chambers, whereas you hint, Phil, at the anti-Israel feeling, which perhaps was latent, was silent, a light sleeper on the left, I think, in this generation anyway, which is now emerged so viscerally. And we are seeing that people choose their TV and radio networks according to their own tastes.
But I think actually the same, Johnny, sorry to interrupt, I think you could actually say that that is the same for pretty much most subjects in this day and age, especially since the creation of social media, that we see that people almost go in pursuit of finding their political persuasion, their political opinion on a matter, on a subject, where they will therefore somehow use that as some sort of gravitas, if you like, and to say, well, actually, this has given my argument credence. Therefore, because I've found some schmuck in the middle of nowhere who's tweeted that Israel is an apartheid state who is deliberately killing Gazans, therefore, it must be true. Don't you think, Jonathan Sacerdoti, that that's half the problem, is that social media is actually also not necessarily helping our cause in trying to counter some of the nonsense and the misinformation that's out there?
I do think there's a lot of rubbish on social media. I've never really been a big fan of Twitter myself. And I think it very quickly and early on became something of an echo chamber, especially for media people. So I think a lot of media people jumped on Twitter as soon as it existed and in the sort of few years at the beginning of its existence, and assumed everything they read there was reflective of the rest of the world, which I definitely think isn't necessarily the case. But I would also say that I think it depends on how individuals want to themselves research news stories that they're following. So they might prefer to read things that they agree with, but I think it's down to our own personal taste. I think that being in a world that's as connected as we are, we're now in the situation that if we want to learn more about a story, we can. So I've learned an awful lot about Israeli news by reading Israeli news. Websites, even in Hebrew, are now easily translated for anybody into any language using the internet. And so really the same thing that's making people hear news from the perspective that they maybe want to agree with is also able to help them see the news from completely different perspectives, not just different positions on the issue, disagreement, let's say, but also different languages, different positions in the conflict itself. And so being out here in Israel now, as everyone who'll come out here knows with any regularity, the war is being covered completely differently from how it is in the West and how it is in Britain. They're describing two completely different things. And the one in Britain, it's kind of made up. It's a sort of Ladybird book version of the Middle East, which bears absolutely no resemblance to what's going on out here. And therefore, the opinions of people in Britain watching it, including Lord Cameron and some of the others, is almost irrelevant because they're talking nonsense about so many things.
That's interesting to hear. So could you, Jonathan, and you, Johnny, then tell us, what do you think the British media kind of got wrong? And to what extent do you think that...
Well, that's influencing.
Yeah,
that
influencing. Say, that I've influencing, got to start work tomorrow, yeah, about 6 a.m.
I'll tell you what, though. There's one thing I'd like to contribute as an answer to that, which I think is a good starting point. I think that when... Wars are pretty horrible things. I think there's no getting away from that. And I think that because of the nature of communications in our lifetimes becoming more and more immediate, there's a tendency to want to see things right now and in great detail and understand the human effects of them. But wars aren't really about the individual stories of humanitarian suffering. Those are, of course, really important features of wars. And, you know, with our own history, I think we would have liked more consideration of the suffering of the Jewish people at times during our history. But, and it's a very big but, the actual story of this war going on here now in Israel is one of strategy and military tactics, one of an army working in a uniquely difficult situation, unlike any even that army has experienced before in Gaza and in the north and domestically in the West Bank and Jerusalem, all over really. And I think that that story is barely told in the UK. I mean, if you look at the BBC, they'll run endless stories about what they, you know, about purported starvation and famine in Gaza. And for sure, there are people in very challenging situations in Gaza, but there's not necessarily a consensus that there is widespread famine or starvation there. And so instead of just the constant stream of individual stories about individual people's suffering, which to varying degrees is real or is completely made up, I think it's really important that the news should cover the strategic elements of what's going on as well, and the wider geopolitical implications, where, you know, this isn't a war between the people of Gaza and Israel. It's not even a war between Hamas and Israel. It's a war between the axis of Iranian proxies around the entire region and the Western world fronted by Israel. So when the Houthis, backed and armed and funded and trained by Iran, are attacking Western shipping going through the Suez Canal, which has slashed the economy of Egypt and affected international trade, or when Hezbollah in the north, where I was today, has pushed well past where it's meant to, according to an agreement it made with the international community and the decisions of the UN. And so all its troops are well beyond the Litani River into the south of Lebanon, on the border of Israel, so there's no buffer zone. When all of those things are happening, when Iran is calling the shots and pulling the strings behind all these proxies, it's nothing to do with individuals in Gaza. It's not even particularly to do with individuals in Israel, though, of course, being here, it is an existential threat to Israel, which is on that front line. And I just don't think the media at home is covering any of that. You would probably be on the streets marching every Saturday against Israel if all you had to go on was the British media's portrayal of what's happening.
Well, Johnny, don't you think that half the problem is that actually what's happened, I think, to British media anyway, is that it's, and I know it's been like this for a while, but basically headlines sell. There is so much competition. There's so much choice in terms of channels, in terms of newspapers now, even battling against, dare I say again, social media, that the only way to really grab an audience's attention is by sensationalizing things. So actually, the reason why the BBC and Sky probably focus on the one or two people who decide to be martyrs and stay behind in spite of Israel's forewarning that an area is going to be targeted and therefore will be reduced to rubble, the reason why they focus on those images is because actually it's more likely to draw viewers to them rather than to actually say, well, did you know that there's a certain situation going on in the north of Israel that actually poses a threat to the country, where actually at the moment, thank goodness, nothing has necessarily happened.
Yeah, it's I absolutely echo what Jonathan is saying, because there is the resort to the cowboy and Indian of this, the idea that this is a battle of humanitarian aid. The BBC and other networks they've disappeared down a rabbit hole, and they haven't emerged in order to tell the truth, the wider truth, the strategic truth. I was saying to someone in journalism that actually, rather than a foreign correspondent or a senior experienced correspondent of war leading a television network for the BBC and Sky, actually they should have the defense correspondent leading the coverage of the war, because that way, what Jonathan is describing, and I think what we all feel, we would understand the wider Israeli-Arab conflict and the Iranian proxy versus the Western world issue, which is really where this war should be understood, would be described a whole lot better. There is a subtext to all this which is going on, which they don't tend to put together, this 2% / 3%, 4% argument that's going on, led by Grant Shapps in this country, that if they could relate that to the Israeli-Arab conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and indeed the Russian-Ukraine conflict, then perhaps the audience might have a deeper understanding. Poland, by this way, is spending 4% of its national economy on defense, being on the border with Russia as it is, and a member of NATO. So yes, I'm all for defense correspondents actually leading the way. I think we would understand the conflict a little bit more widely, rather than, as Jonathan says, the humanitarian issue, which is what seems to be so obsessing the coverage on British media.
So that's actually quite insightful. And exactly in our last podcast on the rise of anti-Semitism, we were talking about the taking geopolitics into consideration when we talk about war conflicts around the world. But I wonder, is there a particular reason you think that the British media chose this angle of covering the conflict? Do you think it's because, as Kevin Darvell, member of the council and the chair of Jewish Ethiopian and Charity Mekata, says, that bias increased readership or sales subscription figures?
So I think that maybe we have a tendency as Jewish people to assume that is the case. I'm not sure it is, because I think there was a similar kind of focus on the war in Ukraine. I think there was perhaps a lack of contextualizing that went on there as well, and a very kind of cowboys and Indians, goodies and baddies angle. I think that it's interesting because I do work as well with Israeli news as well as British news. So I have this sort of dual pleasure of sometimes explaining Britain to Israelis and Israel to Britons. And what it does is open your eyes to how the two countries see each other, but also how they treat news. As a news person, it's really interesting. So I always said the first few years that I was working in Israeli news programs, in English, I might add, but I work as the UK correspondent for I24 News, which has been on air for just over 10 years now, and I've been doing that since they started. Now, you know how in British news, you'll often have the newsreader and then a guest, maybe two guests at the same time if it's a debate, but by debate, they mean you each speak for about 30 seconds and let the other one speak afterwards, and you go back and forth like that, like a sort of polite game of ping pong. In Israeli news, they get like five of you in a studio and you just have a brawl. And at first I found that really difficult because I just couldn't understand how we were meant to get anywhere. But in truth, having done both now for over 10 years, I can tell you, you come out with much more insight into the situation when you've gone for the brawl version. I think we've just got a tendency to oversimplify, make everything polite, very well produced. It all looks very nice when it comes over on air. Also, when somebody says something on air that is basically not true, I do feel a slight obligation to interrupt them and challenge it or ask for more information. So I think that the style is part of it. I think in British broadcasting in particular, rather than maybe as much in print, we like to oversimplify, make it look very slick, very smooth. Perhaps sometimes at the expense of proper analysis, proper facts, proper intelligent debate. And actually, maybe I've gone a bit native over here. I prefer the Israeli version.
But I actually think that there are so many different contributing factors as to why British media has sort of descended into this chaos of lazy journalism, and it is extraordinarily lazy. I can't get over the number of times that I would flick through the channels and they're all saying the same thing, with all saying the same angle, all misreporting the same facts, and inverted commas. Facts, believe me, are not the operative word here. They're saying what they believe to be. And I remember that there was one program in which I was on where I was speaking to a caller who'd phoned into the station. And I was talking about how I don't trust the Gaza Health Ministry to deliver the numbers accurately. And I explained my reasons. I thought I gave a very valid reason as to why I don't believe it. You may recall there was an incident not long after the 7th of October attack, where this is after Israel had launched the offensive, and what happened was is there was a misfired rocket. Do you remember this? A misfired rocket that landed on one of the main hospitals in the Gaza City. Yeah, one of the main hospitals in the Gaza City. And what happened was is it was actually fired by Hamas. But the British media were very quick to jump on to blame Israel, and eventually they had to retract it and say, oh, no, we made a mistake. It wasn't. But one of the things that was fascinating is that to try and recover this situation as soon as Hamas realized, oh, heck, we've made a mistake here, they're going to start thinking that maybe we're the liars in all of this. We've got to quickly report that, did you know that there were a total of 500 people who died in that terrible attack? Well, hang on a second. You released those numbers a matter of an hour or two after that blooming rocket had mislaunched. How the heck did they know that 500 people were under the rubble? There's no way they could have cleared it and counted the number of deceased in time. So the way I look at it is that they are just plucking numbers from obscurity and people are dumb enough to believe it. That's what the problem is.
So with a bit of a chutzpah, I would like to jump in, and as not a professional, to ask, wouldn't you expect someone to check the numbers? Like, how does it happen?
So the problem is, I think in terms of, and sorry, I'm kind of answering this more with a producer hat on, so I know that both of you have done producing before, Jonathan and Johnny, so sorry, can you please correct me as and when you see fit. But in terms of what is seen as an official source of information, has been adopted as being the Gaza Health Ministry. For whatever ridiculous reason, that's where they're taking these numbers from. And anyone who turns around, by the way, and says, well, actually, no, they're taking them from the UN. Well, where does the UN get it from? Yes, the Gaza Health Ministry. So actually, it's only the Gaza Health Ministry that is allegedly releasing the official figures as to the number of people who identify as Palestinian who have actually been killed in this conflict. Let us also not forget, by the way, that those numbers do actually include the number of Hamas terrorists who have also been killed in the conflict, but they don't separate the two. So actually, 20, 30,000, however many it allegedly is, that have died in Gaza since this conflict began, could also very much include thousands of known Hamas terrorists, but they don't separate those out either. Don't get me started on that. In terms of the actual numbers, though, they take it from the only, in inverted commas, reliable source, and that is the Gaza Health Ministry. And that's why this is what's being officially released as a figure. But it's insane. You know, no one is checking this. No one can check it, I suppose.
That's really interesting for us ordinary people who listen to you, Jonathan and Johnny, you know, reporting, and many other people. So where can we turn for the professional or professionally sourced information, which is not biased and just some independent reporting? Is it like possible to find in these days? Because one of the, I mean, I want to ask Jenny first, but also for Jonathan, my question would be, would you say that Israel reports so neutrally on what's happening in Gaza? Do you think that Israel citizens have access to the information about what's happening in Gaza, or is it a bias as well to a certain extent?
I would trust the IDF numbers because every single IDF soldier's life is sacred. The country is small. It affects everybody. And it was reported very early on, indeed by Colonel Richard Kemp, who reported it on a show that I did on Talk TV in late October, that Israel was carrying out deaths of a ratio of just over 1 to 1, civilian death 1 to enemy combatant 1. And he said that was bad, but in the Afghanistan where I was the commander, the rate was between 4 and 9 civilians to every enemy combatant. And that's something that he admitted to as the commander of forces of the British Army in Afghanistan. So you can make a calculation based upon what the IDF is saying. The minute they start saying things like the Gaza Health Ministry, unfortunately, they lose their credibility as a network, and they seem to be able to get away with it. The BBC is supposed to be accountable. We all pay our license fee in theory, and unfortunately, it is a runaway public sector organization which doesn't seem to be very accountable. Sky News doesn't have any accountability to us all, but I would ask you to look very closely at their live stream and observe the Qatar Airways brake bumper around weather and the commercials, the regular commercials of Qatar Airways.
Can I just say, Johnny, I am perfectly sure that in the absence of anyone from the BBC, from Sky News, and indeed Qatar Airways, they would all say that that is not necessarily a contributing factor to what you have just alluded to. But I have to say that in the interest of balance, but sorry.
Yeah, so I'll carry on and say that when Murdoch sold Sky, there was an issue there with the continuation of Sky News as an independent news network. News is an expensive business, particularly television. And obviously they bought it for the profit center of sports, and they have found themselves an adequate sponsor of news, and there is no doubt that Sky News and their editorial coverage has changed since the era of Rupert Murdoch. It's great to see that on the main news building at Isleworth, it is still Rupert Murdoch building, though. Some things stay the same. What I would also say is that one of the key things I've learned from the podcast, particularly in the Emirates, I've managed to find myself a great deal of bridge building and friendships with the Emirates. They have reached out to me personally, and I've become good friends with a number of people out in the Emirates. And one of the key things which struck me was that we looked at, you know, the 8 decades of Israel's defense of its borders and observed that they'd never been at war with the Emirates, and that really helped to steer us towards peace. I spoke to someone in the Trump administration, Len Khodorkovsky, who said that when they were negotiating between Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and the US over COVID, there was a greater understanding about how similar we all were. And that was actually this COVID relationship and the Abraham Accord started to come together. I am heartened, even though Israel is going into enemy territory with Qatar, that probably one of the big gifts of this war, the untold gifts of this war, is that there is a greater understanding growing between Israel and Qatar. When I asked an Emirati friend what the hell is going on with his cousins, his Gulf cousins in Qatar, being on the complete opposite side, supporters of Iran and funding the Palestinians and Hamas in particular, and will they continue? And my friend said that they haven't got anyone to pay anymore because Hamas is being destroyed, and that there were a number of people in Qatar that were hoping that Israel might even win this. So for the Israelis to be going to Qatar to be talking about releasing the hostages, there is a subtext to this, which is at least some form of trust, some form of human contact, some form of unexpected diplomacy growing between Qatar and Israel. And I wish their work, with the grace of God, a great success, that we might actually emerge with some form of greater Gulf partnership the day after the war's finished.
So I think obviously people who want a balanced and fair view ought to watch Johnny Gould's Jewish State, probably.
And good plug, everyone. Good plug. That,
sorry. Beyond that, I must say, though, joking aside, podcasting is another area in which you can hear like a variety of views and longer form bits of analysis of things going on in all sorts of arena around the world, different fields, different subjects, from serious to lighthearted. I think that's one of the reasons podcasting is so popular with both listeners and producers of them. It's because it gives a bit more opportunity for a relaxed, longer conversation about something which often needs a bit more time to understand it. And TV news, even print news, still has this thing of word and time limits, which makes it quite difficult to cover extremely complicated situations. So it's easy for me to say, well, if you want to know the truth, go and read like 5 different newspapers from 4 different countries, but not everyone has that time. And that's why I think most news consumers, a few of them left actually, want somewhere reliable. I think that's why I call out for particular criticism broadcasters like the BBC, because they have an extremely privileged position in the world and in our country in particular. They're immensely trusted as the bastions of reality and truth and fairness and impartiality, that word that they themselves like to use. And I think that, you know, they could do more to earn that reputation than they do. So on a subject that I do know about, I look at the mistakes they do make on Israel, and there are just so many of them in the last 5 months alone, but before that too. I mean, I remember just a little story going on this show they used to have me on relatively often before it got cancelled recently, called Dateline London. Dateline London was where they would invite 5 correspondents who cover the news for channels around the world all on together to discuss the news from slightly different perspectives because of the countries they worked for or came from. And they were discussing COVID vaccines. It was back in that era. Of course, the subject of Israel came up. It had been doing very well at vaccinating the population. And the news presenter said, oh, well, of course, under the Oslo Accords, Israel has an obligation to vaccinate the Palestinians and isn't doing. Well, it was left to me to point out that that's nonsense. Actually, under the Oslo Accords, the Palestinians had independence of healthcare for their people. In fact, you might argue that was one of the things that was the beginnings of statehood for a people that wanted to be taken seriously as a state. And here in this worldwide emergency, Israel was being blamed even for that. And by the way, someone complained, it wasn't me, a viewer. I was heartened to know there was a viewer who complained and said this was wrong. The Oslo Accords didn't say that. And the BBC, of course, were forced to apologize on somewhere 3,000 miles down a very long scrolling page of apologies that only gets looked at by the person that complained. But that's the point. I think the BBC, if I'm critical of the BBC more than others, it's because I think they have a unique opportunity and a unique reputation. Because they're so trusted the world over, they really could use it for absolute good. They don't have the commercial pressures of other broadcasters. They don't need to have brake bumpers that say BBC Weather is sponsored by LL, for example. And can you imagine if they did, what grief they'd come in for? But somehow, even here in this podcast, we had to give a disclaimer to criticism of Sky News' Qatar Airways mentions every hour. And I think they want to be impartial, and yet they're the ones who can't bring themselves to unequivocally call Hamas terrorists after they pillaged, raped, murdered, beheaded, kidnapped Jews and non-Jews from their homes. I was just down in the south again yesterday, Kibbutz Kisufim. I've been to Kibbutz Be'eri a couple of months ago. Just the carnage is unthinkable. You talk to the survivors. I spoke to a friend I've made since then, who is up in further north in Israel now, evacuated from Kibbutz Nachal Oz. Her and her three children and husband are living in one room in a kibbutz. They're the lucky ones. They're alive and they're in Israel. They're being kidnapped. All of those things happened, and the BBC is still harping on about how the word terrorism is tricky to use in certain circumstances. I just saw them doing an event in Manchester this evening for the Jewish community, and I saw a video clip someone sent out, which they're still clinging to this idea that it somehow would be partial of them to label that terrorist. I've completely lost their moral compass, but more than that, they've completely lost any commitment to telling the truth impartially. They have the ability to interrogate the facts and figures that they put out as true. They did a thing on their relatively recent invention called BBC Verify, where they're meant to pick apart statistics and untruths and false news and help viewers see through it. Well, they did one on whether or not Israel's count of how many Hamas operatives it's killed during this war could be trusted. I haven't seen them do one on the 30,000 figure from the Hamas Ministry of Health in Gaza, whether that figure can be trusted. But that figure, I mean, it's so obviously got to be inaccurate, not just for the reasons that you said, Phil, but also it would appear that during the last 6 months, there have been no deaths from natural causes in Gaza. I haven't seen a single count for that. Why didn't they go on BBC Verify and look at the number of deaths that normally happen between October and April every year in Gaza, and then at least take that average off the 30,000? Or why didn't they do a calculation of how many rockets fell short, like that Palestinian Islamic Jihad rocket you alluded to in the Al-Ahli hospital in Gaza that they said killed 500? That 500 number never got clawed back off the running total from Hamas. And yet it's impossible that it killed 500 people. They did even admit later on it killed far fewer, because it struck the car park of a hospital that didn't even have probably that number of people in it. So these things are just demonstrably untrue. And given that they are, it's embarrassing that our national broadcaster and others are just completely willfully blind to correcting those mistakes. I think that there's no defense for it.
There isn't. I have to say that what I am about to say will come across very much like I'm trying to defend the BBC. I want to make it very clear from the word go that that's not what I'm trying to do here. But I think it is worth pointing out that it is not necessarily as black and white as just saying that the BBC should now go on and just correct themselves. where the BBC used to be, and I feel like I'm sort of slightly preaching to the converted here in terms of those who actually understand the workings of the BBC of yesteryear compared to those of today, but it's worth pointing out how it used to be, is that it's not a coincidence that since BBC decided that it had to somehow try and keep up with the multiple choices that we have in the world of media now, whether that be through Rolling News Channel, whether that be through multiple music stations, whether it be through sort of the way that local radio has transformed over the years, whatever it may be, the BBC has, up until sort of, I would say probably the maybe early 80s, maybe possibly even as far as the early 90s, always had the resource that was needed to verify this sort of journalism. And that's what made them stand out from everyone else. When they decided to change the business model, though, to start saying that what they were going to do was try and keep up with everyone else in the commercial sector and offer the same kind of choice as if somehow their listenership mattered. In other words, that their listening figures were what decided whether or not they'd keep or lose something, is where it really started to go wrong, in my humble opinion. So actually, if you think about it, it makes sense that sort of how much, okay, the license fee has gone up, not really in the grand scheme of things that much compared to what is value for money now. I know there are a lot of people who protest about the license fee and whether or not they should or shouldn't have to pay for it. But in terms of what you get as far as value for money is concerned, I don't think there's many people who could quibble with actually what they're really paying for. But it's more about, if you think about that license fee, would go a heck of a lot further if they watered down their services and focused much more on quality and resource. And that's ultimately sort of a massive part of where BBC has gone wrong. Further, more to that, is that they suddenly came up maybe about, I reckon, 10 years ago with this ridiculous notion that suddenly diversity was king and that they had to focus their attention on making sure that when you turned on a BBC station, that everyone in the country felt somehow represented, as opposed to actually worrying about whether or not quality was a more important factor to the BBC. And then finally, what you've got is, as a result of that, is that because they rushed in a load of people to various positions because of this diversity drive, that unfortunately saw standards seriously slip compared to, say, for example, when I joined BBC back in around about 2008, something like that. I had it drummed into me, as I'm sure that Johnny, you would be more than able to verify this as well from your work at the BBC, drummed into me the ways, the values, and how you have to be when you're either in the BBC or on air at the BBC. All of that is now pretty much gone because of these stupid decisions that have ultimately led to a complete dilution in quality.
This streamlining of the BBC output is the most comical because, for example, on a weekday or a weekend, the Five Live Bulletin, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Phil, is the same one as the Radio 2 Bulletin. So the bulletin is on a clock start, which means it starts at exactly 0 minutes and 0 seconds at the top of each hour. And it's a bulletin which is steered towards the Five Live audience, whereas on Radio 2, where Johnny Walker's doing Sounds of the 70s and maybe Sarah Cox is enjoying lots of people who are aspirational middle-class people who send their children to university. Maybe a generation ago they were working class, maybe they were Red Wall people, and suddenly they're having 3 minutes of poison poured down their ear at the top of the hour with things perhaps that they don't recognize at all about the war in Ukraine and Israel and Gaza. It is an absolute shocker to hear. And it doesn't reflect their bulletins at all. Gone are the days when Alan Dedicote used to read the news with slight reverb on his voice because it was like the style of the National Lottery and jolly good entertainment indeed. News is just part of the JY prog, and more latterly Jeremy Vine. It's all changed, and I don't think there's that texture, that understanding of the different audiences. In trying to be all things to all men, or all men and women and other genders, they're not anything to anybody.
Jonathan, how do you react to that? Because I don't think I could have summed it up any better personally.
Well, this is a whole other program maybe, but I'm always happy to talk about so-called diversity quotas and what have you. I think it's nonsense. And I mean, the BBC, for all you say, like in an effort to be diverse, are a perfect example, I think, of how that agenda, generally speaking, when it takes over public bodies in particular, rather like a sort of fast-growing cancer. It does so completely dishonestly. There is no diversity on the BBC when it comes to certain opinions. We only need to look back to the Brexit vote. The BBC had the whole nation convinced that only racists and idiots would vote to leave the European Union and that there weren't that many of them. And every single show was stacked full of Remainers rather than Leavers. So whatever your position was on Brexit, it must, you know, if you'd been an alien from outer space who'd watched all of that BBC news coverage about Brexit in the run-up to the referendum, and a very strange alien you would have been if you'd done that. But if you had been said alien, you would have been utterly shocked that over 50% of the people that voted to leave the European Union, because that was not what the BBC made out in their effort for diversity. They completely forgot to include the majority in most of their coverage, or that if they did, it would be exactly like that program I mentioned, Dateline London, where when I got invited on, it would be like four people that hate Israel plus a presenter who moderately disliked Israel versus me, who is only just trying to tell the truth. To be honest, it's not a question of liking Israel or not liking Israel. It's a question of correcting blatant untruths. Another one I remember on that program was when another commentator there said that Benjamin Netanyahu had passed a law that said that Arabs weren't full citizens of Israel. We hadn't. I mean, there is controversy over the nation state law and alterations to it and what have you, but that was not what it did. And so when things like that get passed, there's no diversity. Diversity would involve them having opinions that they didn't collectively agree with on the channel. But I think what you meant was diversity of skin color and things like that.
It's not so much a case of having an issue with the principle of that. I understand that if someone was to turn on a news channel or a television channel and then suddenly not find that someone looked like them, maybe they'd find it hard to relate to. I can almost understand that argument. Personally, I think quality first above everything else, but that's just my humble opinion. But
listen, you and I dare say, wouldn't think any less of the news if it's read to us by somebody who's black. So that, you know, that's the point. You can't always have somebody read you the news who looks like you. That's just not how being a human works.
Well, unless, of course, they decide to run multiple bulletins at the same time and then you choose the one you want on the red button.
But an AI avatar. Yeah,
I must say that none of us had, as Jewish people, as a minority, any problem in the 1980s with Trevor MacDonald reading the news bulletin on ITV and Moira Stewart reading it on the BBC, and that's how it was in the 1980s. That was absolutely fine, and they weren't made an example of, and jolly good that world was.
Might I suggest two of the finest newsreaders this country has ever seen.
On that positive note, what media outlets would you recommend to our members and listeners as an example of professional reporting and independent journalism, apart from, obviously, as Jonathan mentioned, Joni's podcast? And Jonathan, whenever we see you on the news and on TV and on radio as well.
Peace Talk with Jonathan Sacerdoti and Murtaz Khalil. I24 News with Jonathan's pithy Thames Television style London backdrop, which he photographed himself, one for nighttime and one for daytime. What an absolute pro. And Talk TV perhaps as well.
Yes, I would suggest, Johnny, your priorities are slightly wrong, but yes, almost there.
So. And Jonathan?
Well, all I can say is I very much admire this new strategy of plugging one another's activities. It's far more civilised and British than I'm used to. But I would say, I wish I actually had an answer to that, because it goes back to your earlier question, which is, isn't everywhere a little bit biased? And actually, I think as a response to the inbuilt bias that was not meant to be there in some of the media, there is some truth in your assertion that, you know, I love Talk TV, especially when they invite me on. But I think that, you know, there's no Talk TV and GB News are actually a bit more upfront about their, I won't call it a bias, but their position, their slant. Why do they need to exist? Why did our country launch or see the launch of two right-wing stations in such a short space of time? It's because I think they thought it was needed as a sort of counterweight to the massive amount of, I use left and right very loosely in this, but of left-wing broadcast news. I think that in a way, I'm actually going to buck the trend a little bit and say that if we can't manage impartiality, which is what the BBC says it strives for, we ought to just at least be honest about where the news is coming from in the way we present it. And I think that those stations are more honest than, say, BBC, Channel 4, Sky News. And similarly, as I said, you know, if you do watch i24 News, who I do work for, you must know it's an Israeli channel. It's coming out of Jaffa Port. And therefore, it will have, I won't call it a bias, but it will have an angle, a slant. But I would say that if I'm wanting to know more as an English speaker about a war going on involving Israel and the Palestinians, you could do worse than to watch an Israeli channel. And then maybe watch a few Israeli channels if you're able to understand Hebrew, even better. I watched a bit of Channel 14 tonight here in Israel, which is kind of the Fox News of Israel. And I had to take what they said with a pinch of salt. But regardless, I'll watch over the next couple of days and see if the revelation they made turns out to be even half true, because it was a shocker. It was that the American port that they want to build in Gaza in order to get aid into Gaza through a maritime corridor, according to Channel 14's analyst, is being paid for by Qatar, who have given the money to a Gazan building contractor, which is, of course, part of Hamas. So if that's even half true, this, you know, so-called right-wing biased Israeli station would have revealed a germ of something quite shocking, which is that the Americans, according to them, are getting Qatar to give money to Hamas to build the American maritime aid route into Gaza. Now, I don't know if that's true yet. I it's the first I saw of it. It was today. But I'm certainly going to follow it up and look around for this stuff, and safe in the knowledge that I know that it came from a channel with a particular angle, as every news viewer should, and they should investigate and look a bit deeper. So there isn't one place where you can get your news and rely on it being totally pure and true. I just don't think it exists.
I think if you have a base understanding of the conflict, then when you are presented with a story, you can overlay upon it a little bit more understanding of the situation. Qatar, from all that I understand, pays cash for everything in paper bags. This I was told with Shabak and a story over here in this country as well. And when you understand that they do things like that, then it gives you a deeper understanding. So what I want to say to you is that when you're presented with a story, whoever you are watching or listening to, if you have an understanding, a base understanding of the situation, you're able to understand the story a little bit more deeply.
Can I just read out a couple of messages that have also come through as well? Andy has said that was referring to earlier on when towards the start of this podcast that we mentioned Richard Kemp, Colonel Richard Kemp. And she refers saying that Colonel Richard Kemp also said that the IDF were the most moral army that he knew. I have also heard him say that. He's very, very fair about the IDF. And then she goes on to say that she is concerned that with the agreements being brokered by Qatar, that only 40 hostages are to be released, but there are numerous numbers of Hamas terrorists that could be asked for in exchange. I think that's something that concerns all of us. I mean, this conflation between the idea that somehow innocent Israeli hostages who were taken on the 7th of October is somehow a fair exchange for people being held on either suspected or convicted criminal acts against Israeli citizens is quite bizarre to me. So thank you for that. And then Angelina just finally says, i24 News is very reliable and honest, as Jonathan said. They're sharing more on what the war is like for us here in Israel on all fronts. For the UK, I find Talk TV and GB News report fairly on the conflict, but on other talking points, less agreeable to progressives. And I think that was very fair of me to read out, given that I am indeed one of the editors for Talk TV. Right. I think then in that case, are you going to make a point then?
I thought the discussion about numbers is interesting, but not very fruitful. So on the TV, they report what they see. They can't see Hamas, they can't see terrorists. What they see is destroyed Gaza. They see definitely number of people killed and being killed. I think the numbers, we can argue all day. So that's what's being reported, because that's that's visible. And so what has to happen is, and the we occasionally see the spokesmen from the IDF, very occasionally, and there's no impact. So people, you know, even if three people died, there will still be every 2 weeks a big rally. And that's, you know, that's been happening for a long time, anti-Israel. So I'm afraid you're going to see more of, you're going to see more destruction being reported, because that's the way it is. And people always try and find a human story.
Can I ask then, Jonathan and Johnny, last question. Do you think that the British media plays a certain role in correlation between events in Israel and rise of anti-Semitism in our country?
Undoubtedly. I feel that the way that they tally stories together causes an incitement. And I have found among people who I'm in correspondence with regularly on Twitter that have been radicalized in a certain way to support the Palestinian cause, they took a step back and realized it was a luxury opinion of theirs, that it really had nothing to do with them, and that it was causing heartbreak and misery and real questions about whether me and you and other Jewish people can continue to live in Britain is very worrying indeed. And I think the media has a huge part to play in our insecurity. Having said all that, as a Jewish person, I am extremely grateful that my primary school aged children are learning Ivrit and Kodesh and other Jewish life education in a school that, God forbid, that we have to leave this country or that life becomes too difficult for us to stay here, that they can transport that education to wherever they live in the future. So it has sharpened up every aspect of a Jewish life. And you know you're alive when you're Jewish in an environment like this.
Jonathan?
I would add to that and say a couple of things. I do think that the media, when it gets things quite so brazenly wrong about Israel and Jews, by the way, it's not just Israel topics. Let's not forget that BBC Oxford Street Hanukkah bus incident where a group of children who had hired a sort of private charter bus went to Oxford Street to dance in the street at Hanukkah were abused by Muslim thugs, and the BBC reported it as they had uttered anti-Muslim slurs, and there ensued a weeks or months long fight between some in the Jewish community. I wrote about it quite a lot myself in the Jewish Chronicle. People were hiring audio analysts to analyze muffled bits of sound in the tiny video clip that the BBC claimed they heard the Jewish kids saying dirty Muslims in. And eventually they had to concede that it wasn't there, and Ofcom even found against them on this. So it's not just about Israel. They're willing to spread untruth about Jews. And of course, it has a massive effect. I would say that the current coverage in much of the Western media of the war in Israel is akin to some sort of blood libel. The telling of the story of this war as bloodthirsty Jews are trying to kill and target as many women and babies as they can in Gaza is so wrong that I find it very hard to attribute it to anything other than really quite malign intentions. Because Richard Kemp's somebody that's spoken out quite a lot from a position of military expertise himself about how Israel actually undertakes its activities in these very challenging battle environments with great responsibility to try to minimize civilian deaths, absolutely not to target civilians, women and children, and what have you. So even, you know, obviously that's a debate. There are people who believe that, people who don't. But I do think that it is a bit like a blood libel to allow people to believe that this is a war between the bloodthirsty aiming for women and children and the innocents who are at the sharp end of that. When in reality, let's not forget, it's less than 6 months since actually there was one force which targeted men, women, and children in their beds, in their homes, peace lovers mostly, in fact, probably all of them. And that was Hamas and other Palestinian terrorists who flooded over the border after them. Many of the atrocities were carried out not by people affiliated with Hamas or even Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but by so-called ordinary uninvolved Palestinians wearing flip-flops, using agricultural tools as weapons. I watched a horrific video of a Thai worker being beheaded with a hoe by a guy wearing flip-flops who'd come over the border from Gaza after Hamas had broken through in order to join in the fun. I haven't seen any footage of Israelis pouring over the border into Gaza. Now it's opened up by the IDF to do similar. And so actually it's a massive inversion of the truth. And of course it causes anti-Semitism and spreads hatred of Jews and animosity towards Jews. And then people who've never met any Jews, because there aren't that many of us, have, even with the best of intentions, negative opinions about us, because that's what they've been fed. So I'm afraid that these days I find it very hard to be on the fence on this one. I can only see bad intentions behind it.
I think you're right, and I think calling it a blood libel is actually quite accurate. And I don't think it's necessarily conscious. But if we think about it, there are dozens of countries that were created after the Second World War that involved disputed borders, displaced peoples, who are indeed in conflict right now with those peoples of whom it is disputed across the world. There's only one that causes this amount of rage, that causes posters with swastikas on, that causes caricatures of the leaders with blood from their mouths eating babies, and that's Israel. And I think it's because we've got the convergence of four subconscious hatreds, starting from the most newest. It's this identitarian notion that Jews are white colonial settlers, probably all Khazars. Then you go back a bit and you get the Soviet era, Zionism is racism, and that was a divide and conquer thing against American satellite state. Go back a bit further, you get Islamic anti-Semitism, and let's remember it is Islamic anti-Semitism. It's preached in the mosque every Saturday that the Jews need to be vanquished. Go back further still and you get Christian anti-Semitism. These Old Testament vengeful God and is being represented in Israel, unlike Jesus turning the other cheek and so on. And you constantly hear it even in some of the Christian leaders who are saying, actually, you know, Israel has gone too far now and we must stop our vengeful ways. It's literally being said. So I agree entirely. You get that soup. It's not a surprise that this is where the reporting dribbles, in my opinion. And I don't even think it's malign consciously. That's just the soup they're in.
I will just say on that somewhat rather somber note, then it is time for us to say thank you very much indeed to Johnny Gould and Jonathan Satterdotty, and indeed all those who have taken the time to join us for this evening's recording and indeed participated as well. If I may just sort of end on what I hope is a slightly more positive note to end on. Do remember that in the grand scheme of things, there is actually a very small number of people who even bother when it comes to this particular subject. We, of course, have a very vested interest in it, which is why we all take it so personally and why it all probably affects us quite badly when we see this constantly in the news. But the vast majority of people in this country, in the UK at least, are more concerned about how they're going to pay their energy bills, are more concerned at the state of the roads in this country, and are far more concerned with domestic issues than they are with anything to do with Israel. And the fraction of people who are vocal about the situation in the Middle East, a lot of it is built on ignorance. A lot of it is built on hatred that is inbuilt. And as long as we do everything we can as Jews to try and counter that hatred and to try and prevent the spread of misinformation as much as possible, then I think that at least that is better than just taking it on the chin, like arguably, maybe some of our ancestors might have done around the time of World War II. But whatever happens, know this: Israel is a strong, independent country, and I don't know about you, but I don't think it's going anywhere in a hurry. I'm Yisrael Chai. Thank you very much indeed to everyone who's taken the time. Please remember to subscribe to the Pondering Jew podcast. Thank you all.